the secret is to write good songs. And I think that's where they were absolute masters at. They just kept coming up with great songs. You've got to really think about music now on a global scale. And I think the Beatles put music on a global scale. They were the first international band, just reached every corner of the earth because they were communicating with people in a certain way that nobody else had before. Not easy.
The Jumpsters from Liverpool, England.
The Beatles have held this title for 8 years.
My model of business is the Beatles. You know, they were four very talented guys.
Welcome back to the Here, There, and Everywhere podcast. I'm your host, Jack Lawless. In 1965, the Beatles were unquestionably the biggest band in the world. Beatlemania was global. Only months after their historic performance on The Ed Sullivan Show, they released two of their most iconic albums, A Hard Day's Night and Help, along with full-length movies with the same names. They performed the first stadium concert in history to a record-shattering audience of 55,000 people. They were the biggest band to ever exist.
Here are the Beatles!
Twenty years later, a new group would find itself playing a stadium of 75,000 people. In 1985, many considered them to be the biggest band in the world. This band was Dire Straits. We got to move these color TV. Between hits like Sultans of Swing, Romeo and Juliet, Private Investigations, Money for Nothing, and Walk of Life, Dire Straits spent over 1,100 weeks in the album charts in the UK, the fifth most of all time. Classic Rock magazine heralded them as the biggest rock band of the 1980s. Today, they are still one of the best-selling rock groups of all time. In a 1992 interview with Guitar World, George Harrison said, quote, "I can't say I've really heard anything that gives me a buzz, like some of that stuff we did in the 50s and 60s. The last band I really enjoyed was Dire Straits on the Brothers in Arms album. To me, that was good music played well." Their final studio album, On Every Street, even features production from the Beatles producer George Martin. And joining us on the podcast today is the legendary bassist and one of the founding members of Dire Straits, John Ilsley. A special thank you to my great friend Ellie, my dad, and my cousin Justin for their love of Dire Straits and good music. Thank you to all who have been tuning in weekly. It's nice to see you back this week. And to all newcomers, welcome. This is a podcast where we explore the Beatles' continued influence on today's world and popular culture, decades after their breakup. John, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's an honor to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How are you today?
I'm doing well, actually. I just took the dogs for a walk along the beach, and so all is well with the world.
Awesome.
Didn't chase too many rabbits today, so that was all right.
John, there's so much I want to talk with you about. Between your recent book and solo album, which has a fantastic track list, but I'd like to start our conversation by asking you about a different band, the Beatles. I know you're a fan of them, and I was wondering, how did you first hear their music?
Well, I'd just gone away to school near Birmingham, and somebody came into the one of the rooms, and we had these little record players called Dan Sets. You probably didn't have them over in America, but they were sort of like a record player that had a little speaker at the front and a lid that opened up, and you put the singles on. And so we all had, one or two people had those. And this guy walked in and said, "I've got something here by a band called the Beatles." And we went, "What a terrible name." "The Beatles, who are they?" And he produced this single of Love Me Do. And of course, in those days, that's how we communicated, actually, with the physical record, because the radio was very inadequate in getting across anything new. at all. So we put this on the record player and we didn't take it off, actually. We just played it and played it and played it because we couldn't quite believe, you know, the energy that was coming from this track. It was completely different than anything else we'd heard.
So what was it about the Beatles that was so captivating to you when you first heard them?
Well, I think we became aware quite early on, although the first album, I think Please Please Me, had a few covers on it, if I remember rightly. But they'd started writing things together. That was the first album I bought. I just thought they just seemed to be like the complete, the ideal band, if you like. There were other bands around who were all writing and doing bits and pieces, but they seemed to be producing one good song after another, which is not easy. As we know, having been in the business for quite a long time, it's not easy to write a good song. And in those days, of course, anything longer than 2.5 minutes was kind of banned on the radio. So they filled that gap very nicely by making their songs, you know, 2.5 minutes or whatever, 2¾ minutes. It had to be under 3 minutes. I do remember that. And so I think that we were pretty much captivated by the simplicity of the music and also the quality of the message they were putting across. It was very simple, but it just touched people in a way that other people weren't. I mean, the Stones were touching us as well at the same time, because I think at the same time as Love Me Do coming out, I remember almost 2 or 3 days later, somebody came into the room at school with Come On, which was, I think, the first Stone single. So we were going, oh, my, what's going on out there, you know? So a bit of competition right from the word go. But I think the songwriting was the thing that spoke to me very early on. Yeah.
The final song on your most recent solo album is a hauntingly beautiful rendition of the Beatles song I'm Only Sleeping. What inspired you to record this version and include it on your album?
Well, actually, I was asked by a chap whose name, of course, I can't remember at this moment in time, but he'd put together this idea of celebrating Lennon's 80th birthday. And so his inspiration was to get a lot of different artists, me included, to do a Beatles song, or really do a Lennon song, if you like, because you can sort of filter out which are the Lennon ones and which are the McCartney ones, you know, supposedly. Anyway, so I chose this one. And the band was just rehearsing for something else. Because I was working on an album at the time. And so the band was all in my little studio here at home. And I said, we've got to do this thing. And so one of the guys, the guitarist, brought in a very simple recording machine. And we went through it about 3 times, I think, and that's what came out. It was really one of the wonderful, because I've never really approached a Beatles song before. And it was quite interesting doing it, actually, trying to get the right feel on it. You know, I'm sure somebody would have done it very differently. Well, you can do songs in all sorts of different ways, but I mean, it's not as good as his version. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but it's a vain attempt to give it a little bit of respect, I think. That's all I would say.
I think that the best covers of songs happen when the artist makes the song sound like their own. And that's really what I hear in yours, and I think it's very, very cool. So, John, how did you first become interested in playing the bass?
Well, I, probably like a lot of bass players, found myself in a situation when I was about 15. I'd been playing the guitar for a couple of years before that and was getting, I wouldn't say proficient, but I knew a few chords by then. And I was desperate to join the school band play with other people. And they said, well, you can't, because we need a bass player. We don't need any more guitar players. So I said, I'll play the bass. So that was it, really. And as soon as I started playing it, I realized that actually it was my instrument. So if I hadn't been forced into doing that, I'd have probably ended up being a real second-rate guitar player, which is what I still am today. but the bass just fitted into my sense of where I was in the music. And in a sense, for me, the bass is the sort of bedrock of everything in the band, with the drums. So you know that's what you build on. And so, of course, I was listening to McCartney and other bass players as well. Of course, you know, Bill Wyman, who is, I think, was a bloody good bass player, actually. Doesn't get much recognition from the Stones, sadly, these days, which is quite extraordinary. But anyway, that's another conversation. It just fitted. It just suited me. And I was playing the bass, really, for years before I met Mark and David. And I'd played in about 10 different bands before that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can you describe your creative process when writing bass lines? How do you listen to a song and say, okay, this is what I'm going to play?
Okay, well, I listen to the song and I think, what should I do with this song to make it the best it can be? I don't think to myself, how can I excel at bass playing on the song so everybody notices what I do? I listen to the song and I respect the fact that if I haven't written it, then somebody else has written it. And I just find the places where I feel most comfortable with the music, so that it actually enhances the piece of music, whatever it is. And that's the way I've always worked. And that was the way that we worked in the Straits. You know, Mark would bring songs into the band and I would just play whatever I felt fitted it to make the song work as well as it could. And that stayed the same for the whole time that we worked together. You know, I do love listening to fantastic virtuoso bass players, you know, watching, what's his name? Pastorius.
Yeah, Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah, with a weather report, and thinking, oh my God. So you can do that with a bass, can you? But that's not really for me. I prefer to, you know, be a bit more in the background, if you like.
Yeah, of course. And do you feel like your bass playing was influenced by Paul McCartney at all?
Oh, I think all bass players would have to, you know, give a nod to Paul's playing. I think he's, you know, he's. He's a great bass player. He does what's necessary, you know, and incredibly well, and without any sort of, you know, fluster or problem. I mean, watching him play at Glastonbury this year, I don't know whether you've seen the video of him playing.
Yeah, it was incredible.
It's completely effortless. I mean, he just knows exactly what he's doing. He knows what the song, you know, he's. Because he's singing at the same time. And I know from a bass player's point of view, to sing and play the bass is not always as easy as it looks. And I've had to do it now for quite a few years since Dire Straits stopped and I had my own outfit, because I've been doing all the singing. And I can tell you, if you're playing a reggae riff and singing a reggae song, it ain't easy. So, you know, respect, Paul. And, you know, I love listening to good bass players. You know, I think John McVie from Fleetwood Mac is a wonderful bass player. So simple and so dead right for the, you know, fits in beautifully, you know, with the drums there, with Mick Fleetwood. And I just, you know, I just have respect for anybody who, as I say, nods and a wink to the songwriter.
Mm.
And does what's necessary to make it work. And I think you'll find that's the case in most successful bands, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree.
I mean, when I start on something, I always say to myself, keep it simple. I mean, I was working the other day actually with my son-in-law on a very interesting project, because the girl had sung the song already, before any of the music had been put on it. So, because she sings in a cappella, but she makes the chords out of all her voice, all the different elements of the chord. She sings them.
Hmm.
So, and it was very interesting how to build a track from underneath the vocal, because normally you start with building the track and then you put the vocal on the top. So that was an interesting moment. So I just said to my son-in-law, who's producing it, I said, we've got to keep this simple, man. I mean, this, otherwise we're going to get really messed up with her vocals, which are so gorgeous. And so 10 notes later, no, I exaggerate, but you know what I mean? I think you've got to approach it with a certain amount of sympathy.
Absolutely. And I really think that's why music from bands like the Beatles and Dire Straits is so timeless and great, because each song is built from the bottom up and each instrument's playing exactly what needs to be played at that moment.
Yeah.
And no one in the band's trying to outperform each other. And apart from influencing your bass playing, have the Beatles had any other influence on your life or Dire Straits?
I mean, it's almost an impossible question to answer, and the obvious answer is yes, because you know, when you've got that depth and variety of songwriting over all those different albums and how they approached the writing process and all this, you can't ignore it. You've just got to sort of. Okay, well, that's, you know, I mean, they wrote some of the best middle eights, you know, in music, you know, which was so classic. And you think, God, oh my God, that's so clever, just going to that chord and then to that chord and then it's all done and then, just brilliant. I mean, so I think that most modern bands, well, I say modern bands, would always appreciate that that quality and that consistency, if you like. And it was interesting watching that recent documentary on them, which was done by, I've forgotten his name.
Oh, Peter Jackson's Get Back.
Peter Jackson's, yeah. And what was going on there? Okay, it's a snapshot, and I'm sure it wasn't always like that, but at that particular point, that's where they were. And, you know, trying to get things together, obviously becoming more and more difficult with all that. Past and all that quality of music that went before, trying to do something, if you like, different. I mean, there's a point, I think, where every songwriter doesn't really want to repeat himself all the time with a formula. And they like to surprise themselves by doing something a little different. That's why I really love the White Album, because that was really pushing things into all sorts of areas which they hadn't gone to before. Obviously, Sgt. Pepper was a seminal work, but we all learned from that approach to taking risks, if you like. And if you don't take risks, then you don't really stand much of a chance moving forward.
So out of the many risks that you've taken in your life and career, what do you think the biggest risk was?
Well, I've taken a few, actually. I wouldn't be talking to you now if I hadn't taken a few risks. I think you create your own path. That's all I would say. And sometimes it involves taking risks. You know, I did things that probably most people wouldn't have done in order to find myself living in a council flat in Deptford in 1976 and meeting the Knopfler brothers. I wouldn't have got to that particular point if I hadn't taken all sorts of different roads and different risks in order to find myself in that situation. And so, as I say, we wouldn't be talking to each other if I hadn't taken a few. The biggest one, I couldn't name one, really. Couldn't name one. Too many big ones.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your life and how the risks you've taken got you to where you are now, how did you decide to write a book about all of your experiences in life and in Dire Straits?
Well, I figured I was probably in the best position to do it because I knew Mark wouldn't do it. And I didn't think anybody else should have done it, if you like. Anybody can do what they want. But, you know, I think I understood what went on from the beginning all the way through to the end and all the bits in the middle. So, okay, it is very much my view of what it was like being in Dire Straits. That's why it's called My Life in Dire Straits. And, you know, there are some people would say, oh, it wasn't like that, it was like this. But in the end, it's my interpretation of it. And also it was, apart from anything else, that was the one time when COVID was actually quite useful. It just seemed to, it appeared just as I'd started putting the idea, all the things together. And I had some help from a very competent person who made sense of all my ramblings, if you like. And then we readjusted the ramblings time and time again until we had some semblance of order. But so that was the first thing that was handy, the fact that there was not much else to do. And the second thing was I actually rather enjoyed going back and reliving, if you like, you know, that life, which was, I keep forgetting about it, but when I went back over it, I realized it was completely extraordinary and needed to be documented, I thought, and also celebrated. That time, that story was of the band needed to be celebrated for all the people involved in it, not just Mark, myself, and all the other musicians, but from all the other people that worked with us over the years, the musicians, the caterers, the roadies, the truck drivers, the promoters. I mean, and not least the audience that was huge, which was quite overwhelming. I mean, it was difficult to get used to it. It was, and I wanted to try and get that across, that everybody else was saying we were the biggest band in the world in the 80s and all the rest of it. And we were going, look, we're just a rock and roll band that's doing okay. Will you stop this biggest band in the world business? And because we didn't really want that kind of a tag. We were just doing what we were doing, and it seemed that lots of other people enjoyed what we were doing. So, I mean, you know, I wanted to celebrate that, really. I want to celebrate the audience, because obviously a lot of people have and still are enjoying the music, which is such a great thing to realize in life, that people are enjoying what you've been part of.
So in the future, do you foresee a biopic being made about Dire Straits? You know, we've seen them being made about Elton John, Queen, Elvis.
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure Mark wouldn't give it any permission. And I don't think I'm very keen on the idea either. I mean, you've got to be really careful. I think Queen got away with it rather magnificently. I haven't seen the Elton one, I have to say. It's had mixed reviews, but you know that everything does get mixed reviews. I think you've got to be a little bit careful. I mean, who's going to play Jagger and Keith, for Christ's sake? I mean, you know, and at what stage in their career, you know,
right.
from 19-year-olds to 90-year-olds. Oh, do you know what I mean? So, no, I don't think there's any possibility of that. To go back to your original question, I could have answered it very simply, obviously, like most things in life, but I do ramble on a bit.
So, John, what's your favorite memory associated with the music of the Beatles?
What's the favorite memory? That's a very good question. I think when I was at school and Sergeant Pepper came out and I was in the art room, and I'd also, because I'm a painter now as well, I discovered that I wanted to be a painter, and I had a fantastic art master, and I was up in the art room painting something. I can't remember what it was now, probably for an exam or something. And somebody brought in Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and put that on the stereo thing, and everything stopped. I mean, the whole art class came to a stop, and the art master said, "I think we should just sit down and listen to this a few times."
Wow!
And I remember thinking, and this was in the days, let me tell you, when the schools in England were very, very conservative. I mean, very conservative. So we had an art master that was prepared to stop the class and listen to the Beatles album about five times. And so I remember that very, very clearly. I still know the man now. I see him every now and again, the art master. He's a bit older than me, obviously. But
wow, that must have been like a breath of fresh air for you at that time.
I think for everybody, it was a breath of fresh air. Nobody had actually tried to accomplish this thing, you know, as a complete. I think Pete Townshend did it with Tommy, I think it was, but it didn't have that. I mean, it wasn't quite as sort of, I hate to use the word subtle. I mean, George Martin's production was beyond belief, really, of that, because what was available then was not much, to be honest, you know, but he made a very good job of not much.
Now, did you ever have a favorite Beatle, or did you just appreciate them as a group?
I appreciate them as a group. I think groups are really, they're the great things. I mean, I think they're the ones that make the difference. I think, but a lot of solo artists would probably disagree with me, but I think the group dynamic is very interesting. And I think the dynamics between them probably was interesting all the way through, but the Peter Jackson movie was at a moment in time when things were, you know, a little unusual for them and a bit stressed and all the rest of it. So, you know, groups survive because the individuals in them want them to survive. You know, you can just walk away if you want, but in a sense, walking away doesn't really solve the problem of why you couldn't make it work. And sometimes you have to walk away. I mean, you know, because it's not going to work. But I think bands are very strong because all the individuals in them play a crucial role, whether it be Ringo, whether it be George, whether it be, Paul or John. Everybody had a crucial role in it. And it was, I think it was interesting that the emphasis on the writing was so evident in that film that Jackson did, because George Harrison was really getting pissed off. You could tell. I mean, and I would have got really pissed off if I'd been in his shoes. You know, come on, guys, for Christ's sake. You know. Anyway, but that group dynamics are really tricky. And I mean, I've been through one. I was in one for 30 odd years, so I know what it feels like.
John, do you have a favorite Beatles record?
Well, okay. What about Abbey Road, Sergeant Pepper, Please Please Me? Which one can we pick? They're all worthy.
Yeah.
They're all worthy of being. I think it's difficult to ask anybody which is the best one. There's great things on all of them, you know, and they've all stood up to the test of time. I think this is the secret, you see, with any new musician that I come across, he says, "But now, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that?" And I said, "You just write some bloody good songs. You know, if you write two or three good songs, you'll get noticed." Some people get noticed writing one good song. But the secret is to write good songs. And I think that's where they were absolute masters at. They just kept coming up with great songs. And the Stones kept coming up with great songs. You know, the Who kept coming up with great stuff. You know, the Police, you know, Fleetwood Mac. I mean, these are the great bands of, you know, of the world. And the reason why is because of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all the best musicians in the world, that's for sure. But they're great. Their songs touch people and join people together. You've got to really think about music now on a global scale. And I think the Beatles put music on a global scale. They were the first international band, you know, that just reached every corner of the earth. Because they were communicating with people in a certain way that nobody else had before. Not easy.
Yeah, totally. And now I have to ask, do you have a favorite Dire Straits album?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Oh, that's a difficult one too. I mean, obviously Brothers is an extraordinary piece of work, and we're all very proud of that. But, you know, I mean, I loved making Communique. I mean, there was a completely wonderful sort of time making that album in Nassau, you know, with Chris Blackwell's studio. You know, making movies was I don't know. No, I don't really. I mean, I tell you what, if somebody had a gun to my head, which is quite a ridiculous thing to say, and if I had to choose a Dire Straits song, I'd choose Brothers in Arms, which, of course, is a crazy thing to say with a gun to your head when it's about people not shooting each other. but that's very difficult. It's always a very difficult question to answer. If you ask me who my favorite guitar player was, that's very easy, of course.
And who would that be?
That would be my mate, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So, John, what have you been up to recently? Are you working on any projects at the moment?
I'm always involved in something. Well, the last album, 8, which I did myself, did quite a bit of work with that, talking to people, going out and playing, and and such like, a lot of interviews, and the book obviously has taken up a lot of my time, still does actually, funnily enough. I'm always thinking about the next project. You know, I've got a few ideas already sketched out, you know, for some songs. It's like a massive jigsaw puzzle with me, you know, little ideas come into my head and I jot them down, and bits of music I put on the phone, and, you know, I might come down for a cup of tea in the morning and think of something, pick the guitar up and play it, and it might find its way onto an album at some point in the next year or so. And the other thing I'm doing, you know, quite avidly at the moment is painting. I've got back into painting because I'm going to try and get an exhibition together early next year, I think.
Sweet. That is so exciting.
Yeah. So that's a different thing altogether. The art is a much more difficult thing to do than the band, that's for sure.
That sounds incredible. I'll include the links to everything we've talked about in the podcast description so anyone listening can go check it out. And John, I just wanted to say thank you again for coming on the podcast. It was really an honor speaking with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Jack. Nice to meet you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Here, There, and Everywhere podcast. Thank you, John, for coming on the show. If you're interested in listening to John's solo records, you can find the links to his music in the podcast description. If you liked this episode, be sure to follow the podcast so you get a notification each time we release a new episode. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Beatles Earth to stay current. And I'll see you all next week.